So COVID is in our schools now, and many of us have questions. Well, today I have some answers with an expert who knows all about it. Be back in just a moment.
This is Nero Feliciano, and welcome to the All Things Life podcast. I'm a wife, a mom of four, and a cognitive psychotherapist. And I'm really excited to share these conversations and interviews with you that will hopefully help you live a healthier, fuller, and more peaceful life.
Well, welcome to the podcast, everyone. I hope you're doing well. And I recognize that the day that this episode drops will be the day after Election Day and night. And although I recorded this interview that you're about to hear a few days ago, I am recording the intro at 10:28 p.m. on Tuesday night of Election Day. And I can tell you, we are all a little on edge in this house. I don't know what tomorrow will look like, the day that you're going to open up this podcast, if that's the day you're listening to it. But I do know that whatever happens, we are all going to be okay. We're going to move forward. We are going to come together like we always do as a people, as Americans, especially those of us who are genuine in our hearts and want the best for this country. We are going to come together and we're going to be okay. And one thing I keep telling myself tonight is that God is not worried about who's going to be president, because God is still God and can do God things in our lives no matter what happens tonight and tomorrow morning. So that's just a little bit of where I'm at right now, and I hope that you're doing okay. So today, I'm going to focus on what we can know about, what we can control, and I have an expert on today who's going to give us a lot of information. For many of us, we're getting the emails that there's been COVID cases in our schools, in our high schools, middle schools, elementary schools, and that may send a wave of panic through you. And there's just so much information that we are finding out, but there's quite a bit of information that we already know. And many of us have so many questions about COVID and kids, because we didn't see this at the front end of COVID because we took all our kids out of school. So there's a lot of question marks. But Dr. Kelly Fraden is here. And I want to tell you a little bit about Kelly Fraden. I came across her work actually on Instagram, where she is Advice I Give My Friends. That's her handle. And she does amazing work there and just answers a ton of questions about kids and parenting. She recently wrote the book, which is really amazing. She published this book when coronavirus hit, called Parenting in a Pandemic, How to Help Your Family Through COVID-19. And I will put that Amazon link in the show notes. But it is full of really helpful information that you're about to hear about kids and COVID. I know for four kids, some in elementary, some in middle school, I have different questions about each. And Dr. Fraden helped to answer some of those in this interview. Dr. Fraden is a pediatrician. She's a mother of two. She lives in New York City. I always think about those people who live in New York City when we were quarantined for such a long time. And I'm thinking about them as we're going into the winter as well. She went to college at Harvard, attended medical school at Columbia. This woman knows what she's talking about, and I am just so grateful that she was able to take the time to answer all my questions about kids and COVID and what we really need to know. So here is my interview with Dr. Kelly Fraden. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Kelly, for joining us at on the podcast today. I know so many questions I have for you, and I really appreciate you taking this time.
Yes. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
So let's just jump in, because we are at the point here in Connecticut. I know you're not too far away in the city, where we are really seeing COVID pop up in our elementary and middle schools. And that is really alarming to many parents. We're having to make quick decisions as we get the emails that we're hybrid, now we're remote, and now we're full-time. And it's requiring just a lot of flexibility, but with that is coming a lot of anxiety. So can you give us some advice on how to manage these changes, as well as put the whole idea of kids getting COVID now so frequently in perspective?
Yes, I think It's overwhelming for everyone to wrap their head around it. And the media has not been helpful for parents in terms of understanding the risk to kids, because so often you see the narrative that, like, so many kids are getting it, and it's not been the case through the pandemic. But from the perspective here in New York City, we do know that kids have been getting it since the virus started spreading. Mm. It's just that kids really do better with the virus than adults, and for that reason often go undetected. But now that we're testing them so much more, we're finding a lot more cases. So I think it's important for parents to know that most kids really, if they get coronavirus, will be okay. It's just we have to think about our children's responsibility to their community and make sure that our children aren't at increased risk for getting it and spreading it to all the other people who may have more trouble, you know, their teachers, their coaches, the parents of their friends. We all have like a role to play in terms of maintaining the health of our communities.
Absolutely. Are kids a significant population in terms of community spread?
So that's a great question. And it's something that's not entirely known. It seems that children under the age of 10 are less likely to get and spread coronavirus. I think because they're so much more frequently asymptomatic, you know, and if you don't have symptoms, you're not coughing and sneezing, it's likely that you won't be a significant spreader. Mm. So just to put some numbers to that, it seems like under 10 is like half the chance of getting it. Mm-hmm. And 75% the chance of spreading it. But then over 10, probably around the time of puberty, it starts to be more similar to the risk of an adult, at like 75% chance of getting it, and probably closer to the same risk of spreading it. So I think we think about that. The other helpful number for parents to know is that if someone in your household gets coronavirus, and you don't know, maybe at first, and you're not isolating from each other, mm-hmm. what's the risk that other people in your household get it? And I think because of the way the whole world has shut down with this virus, we really kind of think of it as like a super virus. But it's not a super virus, in that from the studies we see, only between 20 and 35% of close household contacts are getting sick. Mm. So, you know, the risk of if your kid gets it at school and brings it home and spreads it to the rest of your family, it's not definitely going to happen, but it is possible. So we have to consider it.
That makes sense. And because that's part of this virus that's been confusing to people, in that you can live with someone who has it and still not get it and test negative. And we're seeing that happen often as well. So that makes sense. Because I know, and you know, you have children as well, sometimes I have a kid with the flu, but not everybody gets the flu.
Absolutely. And I think part of the reason it's confusing, all these studies, and to really understand children's role, is that unless you're testing everybody, it's hard to know who is causing the spread. So the first studies saw that only adults were causing the spread because they weren't testing the children, because the children didn't have any symptoms. But it was only once we started testing asymptomatic children that we began to understand that they were, in fact, getting it. They just weren't showing many symptoms of it. So then even the studies that I'm quoting, that 20 to 35% risk, I mean, it's really hard to say who's the first one in the family to get it, because so often you can spread it before you even have any symptoms.
Mm. It's so interesting. I guess we're figuring things out as this continues. I know for many parents, and I saw some of the statistics you had posted, and they were very encouraging about the percentage of kids that actually need hospitalization and more significant treatment. It's very small. And what you said was that there are kids who have underlying conditions. Well, so many kids don't, or as far as we know, don't have these underlying conditions, but asthma is one of them that many children have. So can you speak of that, asthma in kids related to COVID and how they may react to COVID?
Mm-hmm. So when I think about risk factors in children for coronavirus, I think of newborn babies, children with heart disease, children who are immunosuppressed, like maybe on cancer treatment. Mm. I think of those children as being at higher risk. Asthma is not appearing to be a risk factor for having severe disease, either in children or adults.
Great.
So it's kind of a surprise. Honestly, I would have thought it would have been. But the data just shows that, like, when you look at people who are hospitalized, the frequency of them having asthma is not more common than the rest of the population. Parents of kids with asthma, you know, you always know your child best. If your child has the kind of asthma where any cold causes an asthma attack, it's possible that coronavirus might be a trigger for them, but it's unlikely that coronavirus will be much worse than the other kinds of viruses they experience. And the best thing you can do to prevent asthma from being an issue is to keep it under good control. So sometimes people only give albuterol as needed if the asthma is mild, but if you're having to give albuterol frequently, having nighttime cough, having you know, to take prednisone more than once or twice a year, you might be somebody who needs a daily preventive medicine. And we know that those would only help should your child get sick this winter. So it's a good time to be under tight control and kind of complying with or adhering to the treatment recommendations of your doctor.
That's so encouraging, especially right with fall allergies and then going into the winter. That's really encouraging because I know that was something that was creating a lot of anxiety with parents whose kids have asthma. My own anxiety with my son who has asthma. So that's really comforting to hear. You did say something about avoiding nebulizers. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Oh, yeah. So the issue isn't to the person who's sick. It's fine, you know, nebulizer. If your child has asthma, nebulizer is the same pretty much as using a pump. But the issue is that having the nebulized medicine around in a big cloud around their head might increase the likelihood that they spread the virus. So if you are an adult and you're not sick and you're giving a nebulizer treatment, you may be at increased risk to get the virus from your sick child. So as much as possible, I would recommend parents and school nurses and things like that, people giving the medication or supervising the medication, to use inhalers with spacers rather than nebulized medication.
Okay, that clarifies that. That's great. Because when I read it, I wasn't sure, is it actually worse for the child? But it's really because of the ability to stay in the air, right? We put it out into the environment for a while. So more risky for the people living with that child.
Yes. And, you know, honestly, I take care of a lot of children with asthma, and I find that families always think the nebulizers work better. But the truth of the matter is that they don't. They, you know, typically deliver the same amount of medication as a pump and spacer when used appropriately. I think part of the reason is because you make the child sit still for a few minutes and you're seeing them after that period. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a time component that makes you feel like it made more of a difference, but it does take more time for the child. So I always encourage, even before this, pumps and spacers.
That's really helpful information. You know, I know one thing, even though we got emails this past weekend talking about the cases in school, what the research seems to suggest is that the actual transmission of this virus is not happening at school where there's so many procedures to mitigate it. Do you find that to be true as well? When kids are wearing masks, when there's distance, when they're doing these deep cleanings, that the risk of actually getting COVID in school is low?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That seems to be the case. And in fact, it's so low. I was reading that in some countries like New Zealand, I think it was New Zealand, that they're no longer recommending quarantine for classmates of infected students because the spread, you know, we've seen from other countries. Now, these other countries typically have lower community incidence than we have. So we have, like, you know, a lot of communities with 8 or 10% positivity. Most other countries have like 1 to 5% max.
Right.
So it's a little different, but these other countries have found that within school, only like 1 of 100 contacts might get sick from a sick student coming to school. Mm-hmm. So the odds are really low. And so when you have communities where the virus is spreading, it can be confusing to see, like, did they get it in school? Did they get it at their after school sports or at the Halloween party they went to?
Right. We're looking forward to hearing about that this week.
School seems really safe. And honestly, I know a lot of places are still doing remote, like San Francisco, for example, and I really hope that they can find a way to get the kids back to the classroom, because I just think the benefits are worth the risk, though, mm-hmm. of course, individual families may need to do remote if they have high risk individuals in their home. But as long as you're providing that option, I feel like most students would do better in person.
I feel like this is an issue that many families, especially with high-risk members, are really struggling over, because we are trying to weigh the social and emotional benefits of sending kids to school, having them interact with each other, especially before the winter. But it's a tough decision. And I came across something that I believe that you said, but you certainly quoted it. It said, "We tend to worry most about the decisions when both options are nearly equivalent." Was that something that you had written?
Yes, I thought so.
I wasn't sure if you were quoting someone else. But can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think there's a lot of that going on right now.
Yes. I have experienced it myself. I remember when my husband and I were choosing a school for our son, you know, we had good options and we spent 6 months debating the pros and cons of each one. And we said to ourselves, like, look, either of these will be fine. Like, mm-hmm. the reason we're talking about this so much is because it's going to be about the same. So I hear families dealing with this often, because, you know, say like you're planning for the holidays and either you're going to take the kids out of school a week before and test, or you're going to wear masks when you're there, seeing your high-risk relatives. And you might debate the pros and cons both ways, because missing that week of school is undesirable for the child and the parent, mm-hmm. probably. But wearing a mask when you're with a loved one is also not something that you're excited about. But really, like, you might be stuck debating it, going back and forth, because in the end, like, if probably is about the same. Like, mm-hmm. it's probably the inconvenience is similar either way. And just picking one and going with it will probably be about as effective and about as good a decision as you can make. There's, in some of these decisions we're faced with, there's no like winning it or gaming it.
No, you kind of have to pick what is right for you and your family and weigh the benefits, right, of both. Speaking just of the social and emotional implications, I was actually at my son's soccer game yesterday in the pouring rain, just like praying that they would call it at any minute, but they didn't. They played the whole game. And what we do as parents, right, to avoid the parent guilt, I was there cheering for you in the rain. So a mom next to me was asking me, so what are your thoughts? Do you think it's worth the risk playing sports because of the social and emotional implications? And, you know, right now we're in outdoor sports. I think a lot of people feel a little bit safer. I know with soccer, there are a few moments where they're pretty close together, but they tend to spread out. They're outside. But we're entering the winter season. We're now looking at indoor sports. Any thoughts about this in particular?
You know, it's really challenging, because we know that when kids are in less well-ventilated areas, breathing hard and physically close to each other, they will have an increased risk of spreading the virus if they have it. It's a higher risk environment. But as you say, we also have to consider the benefits. And we know that when kids don't have opportunities to play sports, they're less active. Mm-hmm. When they're less active, they don't sleep as well. They may be more anxious or depressed. They may actually find that they're more likely to get sick. When you're exercising, you're less likely to catch a cold. And it's probably true of coronavirus too. Mm-hmm. And actually, when you're not exercising or moving around, your academics may suffer. We know kids who exercise regularly do better in school. So there are so many reasons that we need to find ways to keep kids active. I think that for most families, it's worth it to do the sports. Though, you know, there's a spectrum of risk. Obviously, you know, less crowded situations, more stable pods, masking, there are ways to decrease the risk. And there are some sports like wrestling, mm-hmm. where it's just hard. It's hard to imagine that they're not going to spread it.
I feel like I wasn't pro wrestling even before the pandemic, but especially now.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, my own son, I have been playing basketball this winter indoors, and it's the same group of kids and they're masking, and and they wash their hands before and after, and they, and for him, I think it's important. And I'm lucky that my family is mostly low risk, and we'll have an opportunity before we see high risk family members during the holidays to, you know, to take a few weeks off. But for my family, that feels like the right decision. And I think everybody has to consider it in their own situation, because sports are really important to some children. Mm. And sports are not as important to other children. So you really just have to pick based on your specific situation. And you can also consider less risky alternatives, like more distance sports, like track and field, if you're doing endurance running outside, not mm-hmm. in big groups, or tennis. Those are things that are going to be inherently safer. Mm. Even swimming is pretty safe, I think. It's as long as you can be sure that the locker rooms are not a place where you have like crowded changing facilities, you know, being mm-hmm. in the water with the chlorine, as long as you're not too crowded, is probably pretty safe. So
that's great. And that's very helpful information. My oldest actually is a swimmer, and they have eliminated locker rooms. So they have to go mm-hmm. dressed, and they leave right from the pool to our cars. So they don't have the opportunity to get changed, which is why I try and be on time right now, which isn't my challenge, but to pick up. But that's really helpful. And I, you know, it makes me think the fact that your son is doing indoor sports, basketball with a mask on, that that's possible. And I would love for my son to continue soccer with a mask on. Should we also consider in making that decision the numbers in the areas that they're playing the sport, or is that not so much of as a factor if they are masked?
I think it is a factor. I do think that if your community is peaking, like I've been following the news about some of the places in the Midwest right now are really having huge amounts of community spread, mm-hmm. that it may make sense to take a few weeks or months off of the more high-risk sports in particular. And the other thing I want to mention is that parents, like spectators, really have to maintain their precautions, because for most mm-hmm. families, the parents are much higher risk than the children. And sometimes you hear parents saying, our kids are playing sports together anyway. It's like, we're already exposed. But then you remember those percent spreads that I mentioned before. Like if the other parent has a 20 or 30% chance of sharing the germs with their child, a 20% chance of sharing germs child to child, you know, you're taking a much higher risk by having a direct contact with the other parents. So I've seen people sitting on the bleachers really close and that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. the parents I worry about more than the kids in terms of remembering to distance and mask.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We see that all the time too. Like we have rules for soccer that some teams you can't have spectators at all, but on the mm-hmm. teams that you can, there are pretty strict rules about parents being masked. And I know every time we go away to another game, no one's masked. I mean, same league, but I feel like parents are pretty lax about it. And I think they're relying on the fact that they're outside, but they're right next to other parents. So I think that's an important point to consider. We've also been thinking just about, like you said, other types of sports they can do, tennis, skiing, you know, if that's possible, snowshoeing, mm-hmm. just to get them outside and active. Because I do believe, like you said, there is such a correlation between their exercise, their physical activity, their sleep. And we know, especially as therapists, you know, when kids aren't sleeping, their concentration is affected, their ability mm-hmm. to focus, their mood is certainly affected. And all of that impacts learning. So there are other factors to consider, like you said, and maybe the risk is worth taking because of the benefits, especially long term. Because now we're dealing with this at the beginning of winter, opposed to at the end mm-hmm. when it began. So let's talk a little bit about parent guilt. You talk about this definitely on your platform. Tell me the types of parent guilt that you're seeing. What are parents struggling with right now?
You know, one of the groups I've worried about the most is the group of parents who are high risk themselves, mm-hmm. who are having to keep their families, for good reason, more isolated than the typical family. And I worry about them because, you know, they're isolated, and they don't have as much support because of that isolation. And it's easy for them to feel at fault, you know, like that it's because of me that my child can't go to in-person school and has to Zoom school. Mm-hmm. I actually saw an article in the New York Times about this finally this week. And I feel like that population hasn't been talked about very much. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important for them, those parents, to know, you know, that their children will be okay. And there are ways to, even if it's a suboptimal situation for the child, you know, like ideally the child would go to school. Like there are ways to cope, and the value of being with your family and keeping your parents safe really exceeds a lot of the other considerations, you know?
Yep, absolutely. And I think that's a big area parents struggle with guilt. And we're also seeing parent grief become projected on kids. So parents are grieving the loss of certain experiences. I had one, and this is a really tough situation for Jewish young people who were supposed to have a bat mitzvah or a bar mitzvah, and mm-hmm. that literally has been canceled, not to be rescheduled because they're getting older now, and we don't really know when they're able to do this. And that, I mean, it's definitely a legitimate grief. But as you said, kids, they move on, they're resilient. And I think we have to be also careful, certainly go through our own grief process, but be careful what kind of tone we're setting in the home. And you talk about setting the tone. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. You know, I think the children I've seen struggling most with the new restrictions are the ones whose parents are also struggling with them. You know, so I have a few friends, close friends, who really don't like masking. And really, like, maybe they don't, like, quote unquote, believe in it. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that tone, even if they're not saying it directly to their child, it does seem to rub off on the child that they don't want it. They shouldn't have to do it. And so I think that we all have to be careful. I feel it myself sometimes, like with Halloween, like my kids are really young, so they're not as missing trick-or-treating was not a big deal for them. Mm-hmm. But I was disappointed that they couldn't have their traditional trick-or-treating experience. And I had to make a conscious effort to bring positive energy and find enjoyment in the alternative plans we made. Mm. Because I didn't want my negativity to kind of rub off on them. Mm. And make them see what they did get to do is less optimal. So I do think that you can set the tone. You can set the tone for your family. I do think it's helpful to speak about coronavirus with your kids, but you don't necessarily want that to be the only thing you're speaking to them about. Sometimes because it's on our minds and it's so active in the news and all the trying to make plans, it's hard sometimes to make a conscious effort to talk about other things, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but I think it's important. Like life goes on and the ups and downs of children and teens, you know, my son was really upset during the pandemic at one point, and I thought, I immediately jumped to like, oh, it's because you're Zoom schooling. And then before I projected that onto him, you know, ask in a more open-ended way. It's like, oh, I had this library book that I really want to get. And it's like, I can solve that problem. Like kids still have typical problems,
yeah,
even in unusual times. And so to not assume that everything is pandemic related can help with that, I think.
Oh, that's so good. I feel like we can say that all louder for the people in the back. Everything you just said, just that correlation between the kids you're seeing struggle with the restrictions are often kids of parents who are struggling with restrictions. And like you said, we might not outright give them that message, but they internalize it and they pick up on those cues. And they're so much more perceptive than I think we realize. At times we don't realize that they're really listening, you know, and taking in. So I think that's so important. And, you know, we had the same situation with Halloween. We tried to help them understand that they weren't going trick-or-treating, but we didn't make a big deal of it. We just focused on the other fun things that we were doing. Like my husband and I haven't dressed up in a while. We did. My family did. We got together and I bought the candy anyway. I think they had a really good time. But had we, like you said, those open-ended questions are so important. So if we had said to them, okay, so are you really disappointed about Halloween? being canceled. Mm-hmm. I think they may have had a different response than, you know, validating it. It really kind of sucks that we can't go trick-or-treating, but what other fun things would you like to do? Here are some ideas of things that we can do. How can we make this really fun for you?
Right?
Asking them questions that don't have a yes or no answer, I think makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I just want to mention that I see so often, like out and about, for younger kids, sometimes parents, as they're prompting their child to remember to put the mask on or not touch their face or keep distance from people around them, sometimes your tone can trend towards safety. Like, you're going to get sick, put your mask back on. Or, you know, a message like that. Whereas I think as parents, we have an opportunity to like choose the tone to be more in line with values that are important to us. Like, be a good neighbor, keep the mask on, you know, when we're out in our neighborhood, or let's be considerate of our friends and follow the rules, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So you give the child a chance to view it as like an opportunity for positive behavior rather than like to prevent danger.
Right.
I think it can be helpful. And I think along those lines for older kids and teenagers, it can help to use like motivational interviewing techniques for them. Mm-hmm. And so that combines like open-ended questions with like goal-oriented behavior, right? So it's like, you know, asking your teen what their plan is to keep other people in the community healthy and how they think it should be approached and what they want to do. And so I think teenagers sometimes do much better making their own plans than being told what to do. Mm-hmm. Because it's developmentally appropriate. They have the need for independence and to, you know, to captain their own ship. And so they have to be active and involved in some of these decisions.
That's so important and so much more effective. So not using fear and kind of catastrophic thinking, which is very much resonant with our own anxiety, to motivate change, but especially with teenagers who are feeling a lack of control, to get them involved in the things that they can control in making some of these decisions, yes, makes a huge difference.
Yeah. And I think it's okay. Sometimes you may find that children and teenagers are more motivated by things that are closer to them. So it might be abstract for them to think that, like, if I get coronavirus and spread it to my friends, an elderly person may get it and get really sick or die from it. Like, that is more abstract. But sometimes they can focus on things like, I really don't want my class to have to quarantine for 2 weeks, or I really want my sports team to be able to keep practicing together. And if I follow the guidelines, I'll be facilitating that outcome. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it might not be like what the parent's goal is.
Yes.
But by choosing like a child-centered goal, you know, they can find like meaning and motivation to do things that are sometimes a nuisance, like sanitizing and masking and all these things.
That is such a good tip, and especially because it's hard to convince teens, middle schoolers, to social distance. Really hard. But I think, you know, that kid does not want to be the reason that your whole class has to remote learn now, right? So I think, yes. I think those types of motivations can be really effective. Thank you for that. I think we covered, one more. Parent self-care. I talk about self-care a lot on this podcast, especially on my Wednesdays are all about wellness. And I'm seeing that we need parent self-care more than ever right now. This is really taking a toll on parents, especially those working from home, having to last minute help with remote learning or make arrangements for kids who all of a sudden have been either quarantined or have to switch to remote learning. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the importance of parent self-care right now?
You know, I feel it myself. I never, you know, right now I don't seem to be able to get all the things done that I need to or want to get done.
Yes.
And I think for me, you know, there's the basics. Like, I try to avoid drinking too much coffee, which can make me too anxious. And I try to get in the exercise and sleep at a reasonable hour. And those things, those basics are really important at continuing to function well and feel well. But the other piece of it is just being kind to yourself and setting realistic expectations. Like, this is not going to be the year when necessarily you're at peak function and peak everything is the best it's going to be. And that's okay. Like, you know, you're dealing with a lot more than normal. So just like being kind to yourself and accepting that the pandemic stress and changes and preparations and decision-making fatigue is a big energy tax that mm-hmm. like other things may not get done to the same way you want. And that's okay. I think that that's important.
Definitely self-kindness, self-compassion. And as you said, really examining our expectations. I think our expectations are such the core of why we get frustrated. If we just looked at everything that we are doing, everything that is on us, and when we come to those moments where we feel frustrated to ask that question, well, was that expectation realistic to begin with, given everything else that's going on today? I think it's easy to release some of the frustration and guilt. And like you said, just be nice to ourselves. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for taking this time. Your book, Parenting in a Pandemic, How to Help Your Family Through COVID-19. We can get it on Amazon. Is that correct? Is there any other places you want to send us to?
I'd love it if your listeners maybe would want to check me out on Instagram or Facebook at Advice I Give My Friends. Share a lot of tips there. And my website, adviceigivemyfriends.com, has all the links for my book, because there's an audiobook and an ebook. And,
oh, great.
So it's available a ton of different places.
That's so fantastic. And I have to say, I love following you on Instagram on Advice I Give My Friends. It's such great practical information, and I love the way you present it. It's been so helpful. Well, I wish
you
the best with your 2.5-year-old and 7-year-old, especially going into the winter in New York City. Appreciate you taking this time to speak to us.
Of course. Thanks for your time.
Gosh, that was really helpful for me just to hear from a physician about the statistics and the reality of the impact of COVID-19 on kids. That doesn't mean we're out of the woods. It doesn't mean there isn't risk, but so important to put it in perspective and consider all facets of a situation as we are assessing the risks and benefits. So I hope that was as helpful for you. The link to Dr. Kelly Fradin's book is in the podcast notes as well as on my social media. Be well, live full, and I'll be back again soon.
Thanks for listening today. And if you have a second, go on the Apple Podcast app and rate this podcast. I want to know what you liked and what you didn't like and what you want more of. And connect with me. I'd love to hear from you on any of my social media at Nero Feliciano, the Incidental Therapist on Facebook, and Nero Feliciano on Instagram. And you can also connect with me through my website, Nero Feliciano. So until the next time, have a great day, be well, and live full.